some of their other priorities, and specifically climate and their climate protection program. As you know, as part of their regional transportation plan, they are actually looking at how do they incorporate strategies to deal with climate as part of the RTP. I would, however, at this time also let you know what's driving a little bit of this thinking on behalf of the staff, but it's time to transition, is that the issues surrounding the cost-effectiveness program continue to be raised. There's a lot of folks out there that see the free transit as an effort that, while it's important, that it is very much a part of the overall program in terms of the Bay Area Air Quality Program, there needs to be some look at just, is this the best use of public funds? And so that issue, we think, is going to continue to raise its head, particularly as we move to this summer. And I think we look at this time also as an opportunity to start to broaden this program in terms of linking it back to individual choices and messaging. So in terms of some of our thinking is we want to be able to build on the success and the brand recognition of Spirit of the Year, and we want to be able to think about how do we begin to also fold it into our climate protection program as well. So we're thinking about, in terms of some of our initial concepts, is to continue the traditional outreach advertising campaign of the Spirit of the Year program, but begin to work on a somewhat new web-based element that begins to speak to folks' individual participation of what they can do to help protect the climate, protect the air. And we think there's some ideas we're generating with MTC to take a look at this effort to begin to start to get it back to the individual itself. So as we move into this summer, I'm telling you today that while we're still working with MTC to potentially look to fund a couple of free transit days with the Spirit of the Air program, I would tell you this is probably one of the last years that this is probably going to work. MTC has always only had the CMAQ monies through this year available for this program. So they've indicated that, well, we have to transition because the funding is running out. And we ourselves, as I indicated, have a number of issues that we want to be able to work through. And we think it makes a lot of sense to have a little bit more of a limited Spirit of the Air free transit program for this summer, but then also begin to speak to how do we get it back to the individual. So I, Mr. Chairman, where we thought this would also be worked is through the Public Outreach Committee, and then also talk to you about probably through the Mobile Source Committee as well, some of these initial efforts, initial concepts. But I need to tell you that this is an important issue that came to our attention about the same time we put together the agenda for this retreat. Otherwise, I would have probably had it as a big issue as to what you want to do. I can tell you the staff needs probably a few more weeks in working with MTC to gel down and solidify our thinking of what we would propose to you to do this program this year. So I'll pause there, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Comments? Okay, thank you, Jack.
Okay.
Move on then. I think in the Public Outreach Committee will certainly work diligently on coming up with the changes necessary to transition.
More to come.
More to come. Okay. Okay, well, I guess we'll move into the first presentation on wood smoke strategies. I'm sensitive to everyone's time today, too. Jack, you indicated before that we would go till about noon. We have material till about noon. That's another hour. Does that work for everyone, at least? And we can go a little after, maybe, if there's still some time for people.
Yeah.
With that. I just want to make sure we get enough time for discussion on some of these issues, but I don't want to short changes at the end. We're running out of time for everyone, too. So, Kelly, go ahead. It's nice to see you.
Good morning, Chairperson Hill and members of the Board of Directors. I'm here to talk a little bit and give you a status update on our comprehensive wood smoke strategy. There's no doubt that regulating wood smoke from the 1.2 million residences that have fireplaces and wood stoves is going to be a big challenge for us in the coming year and moving forward. We're fully aware that regulating wood smoke is as much about public outreach as it is about developing a regulatory program. So that's the reason why Jack had us create this comprehensive strategy from the get-go, and you'll see a lot of the multi-leveled aspects of it as we go over it. So in today's presentation, I'm going to give you a quick background on PM, talk about our cleaner burning incentives program, cover our outreach program, talk about some of the major issues that have come up with the draft rule that's being considered, and then go over some of the next steps rolling forward. Just in a quick review, you might recall that in December of 2006, the Environmental Protection Agency lowered the ambient 24-hour national standard for PM2.5. PM2.5 is this fine particulate that can go very deep in your lungs. They lowered it from 65 micrograms to 35. And this lowering reflects the increased concern over the public health impacts of fine PM. And as you remember, PM is about a third, wood smoke is about a third of the PM 2.5 we see in the wintertime, and we had 27 days last year where we were over that standard. In this chart on the left shows some actual PM 2.5 filters. The left one is a control filter that never was put into a sampler. On the right is Concord from December of 06. So about in 25 hours, that's what a sampler receives and what can show up in the person's lung. So what happens when this particulate gets into your lungs? Well, the pyramid on the right, the particulate matter pyramid of health effects, kind of shows that. And to orient you a little bit, on the right, we have the adversity of effects. So as you go up the pyramid, you have increasing health effects. The bottom, the width kind of shows the proportion of the public affected by those health effects. And so at the bottom, we have things like lung function, decrements, inflammation. You go up the scale, you have respiratory problems, medication use for asthma patients, increased asthma attacks, culminating in more things like doctor visits, hospital admissions, and death. There's some very poignant studies. Each one of these levels in the pyramid, there's numerous studies published in the Journal of American Medical Association, New England Journal of Medicine, that demonstrates the health effects on children and adults, and kind of ubiquitously, for every 10 microgram rise of PM, you see increased admission rates, you see increased medical use of inhalers, and you even see increased death in those patients that have lung and heart disease. And that's why EPA lowered the standard. So this chart's been up earlier in Jack's presentation. I thought I would just put it up because I believe Director Kishimoto in the past has asked questions about where do we see PM excesses around the bay. So we wanted to provide this information. As you can see, San Jose and Vallejo tend to see some of the higher levels and the most number of days that exceed the standard. But you can see, for example, Redwood City recorded the highest value last year, in parentheses, at 75 micrograms per cubic meter on a single day. And that's nearly twice the national standard. And just recalling from the previous slide, for every 10 microgram rise, we see statistically significant increases in adverse health effects to the public. So this chart kind of compares this year to last year. Last year is in the parentheses. This year is on the left-hand side of those columns. The left-hand is the maximum concentrations. The right is the number of days. So far this year, you can see, which are the non-parentheses values, that we've had a significantly lower number than we had last year. We're not through this year yet. But this is generally associated with the fewer days and the lower concentrations with all the storms we've been having coming through. That mixes up the air and doesn't trap the pollutants in, which tends to create the meteorological conditions that cause high PM. I wanted to cover for you a little bit about our incentives program. We've been working with the board on this, and you've set aside a $500,000 reserve. We've moved 20% of that, or $100,000, into the district's budget. And we're in the first phase of that program, of that incentives program. At Director Okuma's direction, we partnered with the Hearth Patio and Barbecue Association, and this program is basically going to run for the next 2 months. What it does is it targets conventional fireplaces and non-EPA certified stoves, wood stoves. These are old stoves that are dirty, and replaces them with completely or with newer, lower-emitting equipment, EPA-certified devices or natural gas appliances. In setting these dollar amounts, we looked at PM emission reduction ratings for these products, greenhouse gas neutrality, and heat efficiency ratings to try and decide which ones we wanted to incentivize with a few more dollars. Just to go over these pictures a little bit, at Director Torliat's request, we now have an incentive for people who just want to entirely remove a fireplace from their dwelling, and so we will have no chance of that emitting in the future. That will be compensated at $600. Natural gas is definitely great from a PM standpoint. You see there a natural gas stove or insert at $600. In the past, these inserts look more like the one below it, even the natural gas products. Most homeowners don't like that. The industry is moving to something that looks more like a fireplace. That has greatly increased purchaser acceptance of those products. Pellet stoves or inserts are $600. These are very low emitting technology. They also have are considered a zero on the CO2 emission scale because it's a renewable fuel. And then we have EPA certified wood stoves and inserts. Those are compensated less because they still have higher emissions than natural gas or pellet stoves. And then natural gas log sets. This is a very great PM strategy, but it's still poor from an energy efficiency standpoint. So that's compensated at that level. So this program is starting right now, and people can begin going to the Hearth, Patio, and Barbecue outlets, retailers, and start applying for these incentive programs and doing the switch outs. We will nominally be doing press events towards the end of the month to coincide with a national program doing the same sort of things on a national level.
Jerry, can I ask a couple of questions? What is the amount we're putting into this, and do you have a waiting list yet, and does anyone know about it?
We really streamlined this a great deal. Nobody knows about it because our press events will come out towards the end of the month. We're still putting the last logistics in place. The board has set aside $100,000 in this year's budget. We have another $400,000 still in our reserves or savings account to continue this fund this program into the future. The way people get it, we don't have waiting lists, but the way it works is you get the discount right at the retailer. So it's we really streamlined it a great deal to try and get this off to a good jump start. So we've minimized the bureaucracy.
How will this? When I go into, I don't know where Hearth and Patio is in the peninsula area, but when I go in as the consumer, how do I approach them?
What happens is Hearth Patio Barbecue Association is an association group of wood stove and barbecue retailers. So you see them throughout your community, people selling wood stoves or patio equipment, barbecues. And they will have tags hanging on their products. I brought sort of a sample here that Karen worked very hard with them. So they'll be advertising inside the store, banners out there that kind of demonstrate that this program's available in their store, and the discounts apply at the time of purchase.
So essentially if I say I want to switch out my fireplace for a natural gas log set, they will give me $300 off of that price?
That's correct. I do want to also point out it could be more. So some of these products, the manufacturers and the Hearth Patio Barbecue Association have partnered with us to add additional incentives. Those can be up of $240 or more. Some are less. Some are only $150. And also, the County of Marin has a very innovative program where they're offering $250. So there's additional programs on top of the district program.
And will that be included on our website? Can someone go to that and find out more about it and so forth?
Yes, we're still going to spend the next 2 weeks getting the word out on this program.
I just would think this would be unusually popular for anyone who's thought of switching.
We certainly hope so.
Kelly, how much does a natural stove cost, and what is the price range? And then the other question is, on the permanent removal, how do you make that determination?
Okay, first on the price, the products themselves range in the $2,000 to $3,000 range, depending on whether you're buying a Cadillac model or a more simplistic model. Oftentimes, these come with professional installation, which increases the cost. above that. Regarding the permanent removal, what we're relying on is a building permit process. We want to see building permits applied and final inspections done before we give any rebates in that program. And that one, they will actually come to the district for that particular component of the program.
Mayor Bates asked the same question.
Thank you.
Yeah, just in terms of the outreach, can you be more specific? Because it sounds like people who already walk in and already are going to do this are the only ones who are going to benefit, because they're going to walk in, they'll be tagged there. So they've already decided, they didn't know, and they said, oh, what a bonus, I'm getting a rebate. How are we going to incentivize other folks to do it by advertising? Can we buy ads in newspapers throughout the region? Because otherwise, I'm a member of the Air Force, so I'm sitting here, I know about it, but I don't know about it otherwise.
Yeah, that's why this partnership with the HPBA is really helpful. We'll be working with them. They do a lot of advertising to sell their products. We will be doing all the different medias. We will be putting things in print, news media. We'll be issuing press releases and having a press event, too. So we will do a pretty significant program to do outreach for this change-out program. We think it'll be popular. And it's a good strategy to get those high-emitting, really dirty devices out of the inventory and replace it with cleaner-burning technology.
Well, that part I know. It's just the outreach, advertising, and spreading the word. Can we do something in our particular roles as city council members, supervisors, and so on, to help advertise this? Because certainly we get a little bit of press here and there sometimes with some of the good things we do instead of all the silly things that people claim we do. The other question had to do with, I'll leave it at that.
Director Kishimoto and then Director Lockhart.
Yes, I was just asking my neighbor, Aaron here, about what are we doing to totally ban wood-burning stoves, especially in new homes?
Yeah, that is a component of our regulation, draft rule, and I'll be getting to that in about two slides.
Oh, you want to? Okay.
Director Lockhart.
I just wanted to comment that over the holidays, we converted our fireplace to gas logs. And I had two families that came over during the holidays that did the same thing. And we all did it because Lowe's had a great sale. And I think, really, if we look at some of these home improvement stores, and they do marketing all the time anyway. But honestly, that was three families in Dublin that all converted to gas the same week because our entire development had the gas line already in. But everybody was using it to start their wood fireplace. So, it might be just as simple as getting hold of those large companies like that.
Director Hegarty?
Yeah, I've never viewed getting the gas stove as being the problem, to be very honest with you. Yeah. I view the problem as getting it installed. And I really think that if we were going to really help people, we would have, we would do an RFP, we would come up with a list of their plumbing contractors that do this work. And, we would give incentives on the installation. Because like Janet said, Lowe's had a great sale on it. That's the easy part. The hard part is getting it installed. So I would like to see us move towards incentives for the installation.
Just piggybacking on Scott, because I think what Janet has just said is important. The problem is you go down, you buy this, fake-looking thing that actually starts off pretty good. And by the way, I was at a place over the weekend where you can throw something on the fire and it sounds like a real fire. Have you seen those?
They can make it smell like real fires, and then I guess we defeat the whole purpose.
Yeah, it doesn't smell like fire, but it does make the nice sound.
We've got EMs like a real fire.
Yeah, but I think that Scott's point is really well taken. Make it easy, because if you're going to go buy it and then they're going to kind of take you to the cleaners over and the installation, especially in our area where Erica and I live, it's going to be expensive. That would make a big difference to have some kind of pricing in place that says, oh, by the way, we know about what this should cost. Because that's a really forceful point in saying, I'm not going to pay your $1,000 installation because I know we can get it, in another way, and at least you've got a bargaining point.
That's a very good suggestion. We are working on developing what we sort of call the do-it-yourselfer component of this program. It's just going to take us a little bit longer to get that up and running.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to belabor the point because I think I made it, but the do-it-yourself thing doesn't really work for me, to be very honest with you.
Ours would never get done.
Well,
Mine wouldn't either. And, you know, we're talking gas, and I think when we're talking gas, we should be talking professionals for the obvious reasons. But to me, I would think if we teamed up with like a Lowe's or we teamed up like with Home Depot and they were standing there and they're saying, well, this is $150 off, and guess what? The air district's going to give you $100 off on installation. People are going to say, hey, I'm going with this.
Oh, I see.
Oh, yeah. I like that marketing. That's good.
Yeah, and they'll pay to market that.
And, or even talk to the plumbers unions and see what their response and suggestions are.
Their response is that they like tires.
Director
Burns. Very good. Kelly, we have talked for a couple of years now about regulating, you know, wood smoke and regulating specifically residential wood smoke, particularly on Spare the Air days, and you always kind of roll your eyes and kind of go, how are we going to enforce? And I think that, I just think it's inevitable that we are going to have to at some point regulate residential wood smoke, particularly on sensitive days. And I'm just wondering, could we be putting a fee on firewood toward that goal? And because you walk into Costco or someplace, there's particle logs and there's specials on particle logs, and you go, what are we doing? There ought to be a fee on these things. What about that?
Chair, I still do have two or three more slides.
You're on.
Okay. That is coming up in two more slides. So that's our incentives program. It's going, we'll be kicking off press events later this month. Just to review a little bit about our outreach program, because this effort is very much about getting the word out to the public, and is as much a public outreach program as it is a rule development program. Our main challenge here is people's perception that wood burning is good, but wood smoke has some really bad health effects associated with it, especially when the weather does not cooperate. So what we've been focusing on is informing the public about the public health effects of PM, and we're going to continue on that effort and bring more health study messages to that outreach effort. We're going to communicate the wood smoke rule development effort, the rulemaking effort, and I'll go into that in a little more detail. We're promoting this incentives program, and we're going to be expanding the outreach program to reach a broader audience. We realize there's some challenges with this program, and so we're going to be trying to get the message out in a wider audience. So in the rule, we have several different requirements. A mandatory curtailment was a component of the rule. We also limit the opacity of the plume. We don't want dark plumes. That means bad combustion. We are required cleaner burning technology in new construction, and that's what Director Kishimoto was referring to. We prohibit garbage burning or toxic wood burning in our draft rule, and we require seasoned wood sales to be labeled and talk about the health effects of PM and the curtailment program. So this draft rule went out to public workshop. Director Ross attended many of the hearings, as well as some of the other board members. They were fairly well attended. They were in Oakland, Santa Rosa, Concord, Vallejo, Redwood City, San Jose, and Livermore. We even did live webcasts for all seven of them to try and get as much outreach there and allow people to participate no matter where they live. We had approximately 150 people attended, 40 registered via webcast, and about 255 emails sent. This doesn't include direct correspondence that maybe went to you as an elected representative. We had 48 TV, radio, print interviews, 100 printed articles, and about 75 phone calls. So overall, we received approximately 370 comments, breaking down about two-thirds in favor of the regulation and one-third objecting to the regulation. But as we all know, the one-third objecting was pretty vocal and effective in their efforts. The majority of the objections were on this first issue here, was that the rule should allow EPA-certified devices and pellets so to allow it to be burned during curtailment periods. There, we're going back to the science. We're a very science-based organization. We're looking at analyzing whether the emissions from those devices will adversely impact our attainment with that standard, or how bad it will be, and see if we can allow any room for EPA-certified devices. And the second issue that's cropped up recently that the board should be aware of is that there's a CEQA issue hiding within this wood stove strategy in our regulations and our changeout program. And that is, we are incentivizing or requiring in the rule people to switch from a renewable resource that has a CO2 footprint of zero to fossil fuels, natural gas. And does that result in a CEQA issue? We're currently trying to quantify the impacts of the CO2 increases, and this is an issue that we're going to continue to work on and develop. So some of the next steps, expand the wood smoke outreach. You know, we just need to let people know. We want them to burn responsibly and smartly. And so we're going to work on getting that message out there. We're going to kick off the incentives program later this month. We have to respond to the 370 comments we received in the draft rule, and we'll be revising the regulation. And we anticipate conducting a second round of workshops in the spring, late spring of this year. We have to complete a socioeconomic, a CEQA review, and then we'll be moving towards a public hearing sometimes in mid-2008. So that concludes my presentation, and I'll be happy to answer any additional questions.
Thank you, Kelly. Vice Chair, go ahead.
Thank you. A couple of issues. One, and I brought this up at some of the other committee meetings, but my concern is the long-term vision that we have about PM and how we're going to attain the PM standards. And at the federal level, my understanding is that we kind of took the easy way out and didn't actually reduce the PM levels to what we will probably be facing in the future. And if that, in fact, is the case, I am concerned about the message that we send through an incentive program that says, you know, we want you to continue to burn wood, and even if it's in EPA standard.
That's the same material.
And I am very concerned that the district gets behind promoting that kind of an incentive, and then 3-4 years from now, when the federal standard is reduced, that we're not going to be able to meet those PM emissions, and we're going to have to go back and say, you know what, those EPA stoves that we're burning wood in isn't going to actually meet the targets that we have for the long-term vision. And so I'm very concerned about the long-range vision, and I need, again, some more information for us as directors to understand what the long-term goal is. And secondly, on the EPA certified, or allowing EPA certified stoves to burn during Spare the Air Night, I just really feel like that's sending the wrong message. This now is a voluntary program on Spare the Air Nights, and we should be telling people not to burn, period. It's something that I think that we need to be consistent on from the district standpoint. And I know that what's being proposed is steps to get there. But it seems to me that we're going to have to re-educate again after we potentially don't meet the threshold that we need to meet. So that's my...
Jack, did you have a comment?
Yeah, what we're trying to balance is the fact that you've got folks that have made the investment in some of these technologies, and now essentially they're saying, you don't want to allow me to burn them when even on these pretty restrictive conditions. And that's an issue we're having the people to deal with. It's also a matter of just trying to balance all the kind of concerns that are coming. And so I will tell you, at least staff is leaning towards this concept about allowing for folks to burn these cleaner technologies on a night in which we do call a Spare the Air Night, even though I know Director Torlett may not necessarily agree with that. It has to do with, in large part, because of the response back to this concern by a lot of folks that have said, you know, if I've made the investment, why is it that we can't recognize that? So, understanding we do have a longer-term picture, we also understand that EPA might indeed lower the ambient standard as well, down from 35 to 25, which is what they kind of thought about doing as part of their last amendment.
But wood smoke does represent an important fraction of PM, but it's not the only PM. So we would take a look at all of the PM sources as we continue to violate the standard and recommend other proposals to you as well to deal with this issue.
So. Thank you, Chair. Director Ross, Director Haggerty, Director Szymanski, and Director Shimoda.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to say yes, Director Dorlatt does have Vice Chair Dorlatt does have a very good point, salient point about, you know, we're asking people to change out. We don't want to make it look like an MTBE scenario down the road where, whoops, didn't need to have you do that. But there are the ancillary benefits on non-spare-the-air nights where that cleaner technology is now in place 365. You know, every night of the year that they choose to burn, it's going to be a reduced emission. So the quantity of PM is reduced overall on a daily basis, so we can't overlook that. And we have to take steps forward, but I really wanted to emphasize that education that I learned in the workshops is once you talk to people and tell them the impact of PM on their neighbors, they back down a little bit. And I use in my phraseology, I call it secondhand wood smoke. And that just, the dots connect. And they go, okay, I get it. I mean, if it was just you breathing it, fine. But it's secondhand wood smoke. So as I hope to guide the public outreach to more intensive work, education on this matter, because that's going to pave the way for greater acceptance. Whatever we do, people have to understand what the consequences are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to go back to what I was talking about earlier, and I really wish that we as a board would instruct staff to come back to the program that helps with the installation of these fireplaces, natural gas fireplaces, because I've mentioned it over and over in the past, and it doesn't seem to get any traction. I think it could have issues to deal with liability and things like this, but the fact of the matter is you can require people to carry certain amounts of insurance that are indemnified in the air district. And there's a lot of plumbers that are out there in the work, so I'd really like to see that as an action item. But I would also like to ask, are you running a test on climate change today in this room? Because 1 minute's at 40 degrees, and it goes to 80, then it goes to 40. Right now, you know, I'm in the Antarctic.
Thank you, Scott. I mean, I just turn it off.
So if you're doing some meaningful thing, let me know.
It is just freezing in here. And it's
the log on the fire. It's a little hot for a while. But let me go back to Scott's comment. I think, you know, when you bring something back to public outreach committee, I think if you can look at that issue of incentivizing installation and see how it should be done and what the challenges or opportunities are incorporated with that so that we can make a policy decision one way or the other, that'd be great. Thank you.
I'd like stationary source. I mean, source. I mean, we can...
Just chair, sure. But is that a stationary source?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We thought we'd bring it to the station.
That's perfect.
Bring it
on. Thank you.
Besides putting a log on the fire, but it is getting cold on this side. But we talked about the incentives and the ads for going up. You know, this ad was in the Chronicle, and it's really a nice ad that Macy's put in there about burning wood, burning logs, and stuff like that. We've got to get this. We've also got to get to these kinds of people that are showing pictures like this of how nice
that,
it is.
Is that the fake one?
These are real logs being burned there. And the other thing I wanted to say, in the public hearings that I attended, the most vocal people were the ones that were talking about enforcement. How are we going to enforce this? You know, are we sending neighbors out to, you know, knock on the door and put out your fires, that sort of thing? So I think somehow enforcement's got to be included in what we're talking about.
What's your
name?
What's your name?
Well, let me see. I guess three
good
points. I guess one is the Pam's point was, we don't want to have people make new investments in something that's been banned in 2 or 3 years.
Can you hear our
arguments? No.
So, can you speak up a little bit, Tiffany?
One point is, we don't want to have people make a heavy investment in the technology that is going to be banned in 5 years. So, as much as we know about future regulations or about science, it would be nice to kind of aim at that. So, even if there's a rebate of $300, if they're going to spend $1,000,
Well, let me try and clarify a few things that might help the board evaluate this issue a little bit better. So I opened the talk talking about 1.2 million households in the Bay Area that have fireplaces or wood stoves. There's about 2.5 million residences, only about half of which have a wood-burning device or something of that sort. You have apartment buildings that have none and that sort of thing. Of those 1.2 million, based on our telephone survey, we estimate that 300,000 to 400,000, Eric, is that about the range, have a wood-burning device that would be in this sort of incentive program range. Our HPBA partners tell us that the Bay Area is a natural gas market on its own without any incentive programs. That 75 to 80% of the products they sell out the door are people going to natural gas products. I think it's because we're somewhat of an urban environment. People don't like to haul wood around the house, that sort of thing. So in general, independent of the gradations and the dollars here, there's a lot of natural desire just to go to natural gas. I think Director Lockhart articulated that well within her own neighborhood. So I think in this incentive program, you see a big shift to natural gas for PM. That's great. That's absolutely super. And then the other thing I just wanted to provide is when we're looking at spare the air nights where PM really increases to the point where it's unhelpful from a public health aspect, that's only 27 out of 365 days a year. Outside of those winter months, we virtually never see a PM excess. And we actually have a lot of burning that goes on in the basin there outside of residential, from agricultural burning, prescribed burning, wildland management, that far dwarfs the inventory as far as single-family homes and residential burning. Since those months, we have a lot of air movement, the PM can't build up. So the concept of people having wood-burning appliances that are subsidized $300 by the district allows them to preserve choice and allows them to sort of burn those other times of the year than those 27 days.
Okay, and just to finish my second point was, I don't know if you've talked about it already, but for new homes, I mean, we still allow new wood-burning.
That is a component in the draft rule, and so far it has not been controversial. That's largely in part to everybody's effort to adopt the model ordinance, which has that component in many of the cities and counties in the Bay Area already.
Okay.
So this just puts it uniformly throughout the nine Bay Area counties.
Okay.
Director Dunnigan?
Oh, can I just make my third point was just to say that, as people kind of lower the temperatures in the homes in general, so people want kind of some localized heat, which is one reason why people, so it'd be nice to almost kind of think long term about, is there something else? Because
space heaters
subsidies.
Well, I'm serious.
Some paradigm shift.
Yeah, through the chair, I was going to say that when they do roll out with Kelly's plan, maybe a TV commercial with Jack Broadbent. He's becoming a public figure now.
Certainly.
To really sort of lay out what the good stoves versus the bad.
Sounds nice and folksy, doesn't it, on the radio?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Radio.
Yeah.
What's on TV?
I think I like TV.
Don't try the fire.
That Jack Broadbent.
Yeah.
Why don't you do this?
I mean, it's effective.
Jack's fireside chat.
Yes.
Yeah. So perfect.
Without the fire.
Without the fire.
Well, you could just have somebody there.
Really, I wanted to put in a plug just to consider in your strategy to consider IR cameras or infrared cameras, not necessarily for enforcement, but maybe for enforcement in the long term. But even for promotion, we could just spend our dollars so much more wisely, because I can imagine that if we set up a camera in West Valley, we'd come up with about 20 locations where there was particularly big emissions of particulate, and that we could focus our outreach on those locations. And that would be so much better, so much more efficient spending of our outreach dollars.
That's a good idea. We do have an IR camera in our possession. It's particularly useful to identify hydrocarbon emissions.
Right.
We have tasked it to wood smoke in sort of a fashion that you indicated, and we've sort of done some observations in Concord and Napa, and we will be down in the South Bay when the meteorology sets up for a good observation.
Great.
Non-statistically valid, but rough sampling is anywhere from 7 to 10% of the households are burning on those nights.
And the only thing I'd say to that is that the technology has progressed quite a bit. I think you'd find some pretty good IR cameras out there right now that you'd even see whether or not it's wood being burned. So I think it'd be worth at least considering a mobile camera setup.
We'll look into that. I don't know if our cameras have that level of sensitivity, but that's a good suggestion. We'll look into
it. Okay, Tom?
Just very briefly, sort of following up on that discussion. Do the people traditionally, when they burn at night, is that actually start in the daytimes, in their daylight hours before they start burning, or is it just in the evening?
I think that's something that we're looking to get out of some of our telephone surveys. We can tell that we need to look more at people's burning practices. Right. From the air monitoring data, it's pretty clear that people sort of come home from work, have dinner, and then light fires. That's our belief from looking at the pollutant traces, because we see a very dramatic rise into the late evening hours, and then it peaks around midnight as the fires smolder, we believe, as the fires smolder in the fireplaces after people have gone to bed. So we think the signature is very indicative of fireplace emissions and smoldering fires post-dinner.
Are there any questions? Other questions? Tom? Perfect. That was great. Well, what we're going to move on now. I think you've got direction. Thank you for the comments from everyone, because I think that move is forward and to a plan and an ordinance that hopefully we'll be able to live with first, and then the community will secondly. We'll move on now to the community risk evaluation. We're not going to take a break now, or either now nor after the community risk evaluation program. If you have to, if you need a break, take it, then come back. You won't miss much, because we'll be doing a lot of hard work here as we go on. So, Henry.
Good morning, President Hill, members of the Board of Directors. I will be brief because I know time is short. I'm just going to give an update on the CARE program, but really focusing on some things we'd like to do this year on the mitigation side to reduce risks, to reduce exposure to air toxics. We've been very busy last year, and we'll continue this year on the technical side. We've been updating the emission inventory. We've been doing modeling at the regional level and at the local level, particularly in the risk assessment that Director Hill mentioned in West Oakland. We've also been working with ARB on a risk assessment in Richmond on the BMS at Rail Yard. We're expanding our monitoring system in West Oakland, a lot of community outreach. But let me jump into the mitigation side, because I think that's what the board's most interested in. But I will, before I get to that, I do want to mention the modeling. We've done some preliminary modeling with the existing year 2000 inventory, and this the figure on the left shows that. The figure on the right is our emission inventory. This you've seen many times before. This is a particulate matter, 2 kilometer grid squares throughout the region. You're quite familiar with this figure. And so what we've done now is we've used a model to, and certainly those emissions give us a very good picture of where the impacts are greatest in the Bay Area. But what the modeling lets us do is factor in meteorology, topography, to see how those factors influence the emissions as they move around during the day, and what people are actually breathing. And so that's the value to the modeling. And so you can see it compares pretty, the colors here are not as good as they are on my screen, but you can see the modeling results track pretty closely with what we've seen with the inventory, not surprising, but there are some differences. For instance, you can see if you look at the 880 corridor in Alameda County and the 101 corridor in San Mateo, on the inventory side, they look pretty similar. The level of emissions look pretty similar. But when we modeled it, you see the estimated concentrations in the 884 probably are a little higher. The model tells us they'll be a little higher than on the San Mateo in 101. And that's probably because the winds are greater, that the winds blow from the west and would disperse those emissions more readily. And perhaps in Alameda County, the winds, it would be obstructed by the hills, and we would see higher concentrations of the pollutants on the 880 corridor. So that's why the modeling is really important for us and would be valuable in focusing our mitigation strategies. So let me turn to that. Brian and Jack have talked about the Green Ports Initiative. Certainly the CARE data has been very important underpinning to that effort. As has been mentioned, the emission inventory for West Oakland has been very, very helpful and will continue to be so in the Green Ports Initiative. What we want to do is increase our outreach to cities and counties on their local land use decision. This comes up again and again. when residential areas are proposed near sources of air pollution. Director Alcomo met with us several times last year on a project in Herb County where this came up, and I'm sure you all wrestle with this in your local jurisdictions, particularly as we're now trying to really focus smart growth, infill development, transit-oriented development. Are there situations where infill and transit-oriented development may put residential areas near sources of air toxics? We have regulatory authority over the sources. We can control the sources very well. We don't, the district does not have authority over those local land use decisions that might place residential areas near sources. And so that's where we really want to work with the cities and counties to provide them tools to make informed decisions when they, where they, as they consider their local land use decisions, where to really be careful about residential development. So we are in the process of developing a guidance document to help cities and counties make those decisions. We want to meet with the cities to have some workshops or one-on-one meetings. We have a meeting in a couple weeks with staff from the San Francisco Department of Health on a draft guidance document that they're preparing in San Francisco on residential development near roadways. So we think that working with local land use officials is really an important part of our going forward with reducing exposure. We do a lot of work on outreach. We meet all the time with community groups. Last week, we met with folks at West Contra Costa on their local air toxic concerns. Just this afternoon, staff is going down to meet in San Jose with local elected officials and city staff on concerns about toxic emissions near from the San Jose airport. So we do a lot of meeting with local officials and community groups on their local concerns. And we also, what we'd like to do is continue to focus our grant and incentive funding in the areas that are really highlighted through the CARE program as being most impacted, either from high levels of emissions and or levels of sensitive populations, youths, seniors. We've done that a little bit already. So that would be through the Carl Moyer program, but possibly other grant programs as well. We've done this a little bit through the Carl Moyer program, but state law requires that of our Carl Moyer funding, 50% of that funding be directed into the most impacted communities. And so the figure on the right is a map that we used at the last round of our Carl Moyer program to help staff evaluate the Carl Moyer applications and focus that funding. And what this shows is we've weighted, we've taken the sensitive population, which we've defined as youth and seniors, under 18 or over 64, and weighted the emissions and the population of those youth and seniors for all the grid squares throughout the Bay Area. And the red areas are the top 25%, the sort of greenish area is the top 50%, and then what appears to be a grayish area is the top 75%. And then the hatching brings in income. That is the lower income areas are the areas that are 40% under 185% of the federal poverty level. So that is what we've been doing and plan on and hope to continue to do. And what we'd like to do now is zero in even further and within these areas to identify four, five, six areas that really jump out at us as having the highest emissions and the highest concentration of sensitive population and focus in even further, perhaps 25% of our Carl Moyer funding in those specific communities. Still targeting these other highlighted communities, but really focusing in a subset of our funding in those highest impacted communities. And so we'd like to propose that for your consideration. We'd be talking to the mobile stores guy about that concept this year. So that's my Reader's Digest version, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Great. Thank you very much, Henry, for your promptness. Director Nixon and Director Mulder.
First and foremost, asked nicely. I didn't know there was a meeting in San Jose this afternoon, which is what I represent. So could you tell me more about that? And it would seem to be advantageous to have my policy agency here, Scott Strickland, attend that. But could you somehow notify us of when you're going to be in our area? The possibility of funding in some way is obviously very interesting to us, and it looks to me as though Santa Clara in that area is, even though you don't have a lot of red, you have an awful lot of the next color,
right,
greenish. And so could you give us some more information? Why are you going? Did you set it up? Did they set it up? How How was this done?
Well, this was at the city's request, really, and I think the airport also. There have been some concerns by community members about emissions from the airport, and so City of San Jose staff have contacted our staff, both the care staff and technical division staff in our monitoring section, to come down and talk about. They're interested in hearing what our local monitoring station, our San Jose Air Toxics Monitoring Station, what sort of data we're finding there, and if we can help sort of track emissions from the airport to that station. So one of the things we've been doing is looking at data from that monitoring station, looking at meteorological conditions, and so when there are days when it looks as though the winds are blowing from the airport to that station, are we seeing any difference in the levels of pollutants that we're recording? And we've also been working with them on identifying mitigation strategies, what projects could be funded.
Can you tell me where you'll be and when?
Phil?
We can get that.
But just give it to Scott. Okay. Scott's right there with a red tie on.
And perhaps it's not a bad idea when you do make presentations in the jurisdictions that we all represent, if we can get a heads up to that, so we know what's going on.
Yeah, it really would help us a lot. Otherwise, I hear it secondhand, and then counties sometimes do not feel like they are front and center to the cities.
We'll be sure to do that.
Thank you.
There's a lack of love.
Yeah. Right.
If you're not running head on into a kind of a collision of conflicts of purposes, you're certainly running sidewise into this in terms of land use with the issues with transformation of industrial lands and the populations that are coming into some of those transformations where residential developments are coming in. You've got, I guess what they call, the Republicans call it new urbanism, the Democrats call it smart growth. It's basically the same thing, the concentration of populations proximate to the workplace and also proximate to hubs and corridors for transportation. How do you, and again, this will be the details that will come devilishly later, but how are you framing this question? Because the areas you're looking at are the areas of the concentration of jobs, and given sort of the global transformation and the exportation of the pollution problem to other countries, given, you know, the so-called global economy. How are you dealing with this in terms of the conflict with retention of jobs, attraction of jobs, smart growth, urban, new urbanism, whatever you call it? This is a tough issue, and I know San Francisco obviously better than any place here. I've been on the Land Use Committee chairing it most of the time for the last 7 years, and we're trying to develop the eastern side of the city for residential purposes, at the same time retain jobs. A lot of them are lower polluting jobs, and so as you go with the contra costa, you can see, we know the reality there, you promote the East Bay there, you know the reality there. How are you dealing with this issue? Because this is really a Gordian knot you've taken on.
It is a tension. You're absolutely right. Two years ago, ARB issued a guidance document, a handbook on local land use decision making that provided generalized guidance on this issue. And for those of you that are on the Joint Policy Committee, there was a presentation at JPC about that document. And that gives general, it's sort of general heads up for local decision makers on it. And they give general, very generalized buffer zones around various sources of air toxics, and one of them is 500 feet around heavily traveled freeways. Well, that's very, I mean, it depends very much on local traffic volumes, topography, winds, all sorts of things. And so what we want to do is be able to take that generalized guidance and make it more useful to each of you as you make your local decisions. So where in the city of San Francisco do you really have to be extra careful, and where is infill development probably appropriate? I don't have the answer for you today, but that's what we want to be able to do is provide more detailed guidance to the local officials on that question. And the other point I'd make is that we're hopeful that the fleet will continue to get cleaner through our grant programs and regulatory programs, ARB's very aggressive regulatory programs. It may be that cases that areas today look a little dicey, that might be a concern a few years down the road as the fleet is cleaner, maybe then it's not as much a concern.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a problem in looking at that, and what I understand is what is happens in 880 corridor in the morning as far as generating emissions basically migrates over and settles into the Tri-Valley, and no further, by the way, it doesn't go beyond the county line. So I'm a little, I don't understand. I mean, I know statistics such as the I-580 corridor is the second and third worst commute according to Caltrans in the nine Berry counties. It's a region in which, from time to time, we are put in non-attainment. It's where we have our exceedance and spare the air days. And yet I look at that map, and you tell me everything's wonderful out there. So, and I understand that in order to clean the air, you have to clean the 880 corridor. That I get. But what I don't get is how you can tell me we're now going to ignore the I-580 corridor, where actually the pollution and the emissions and everything, you know, is all settling. So this isn't making sense to me, and I'm going to tell you, if you're going to use this map to now say, well, this is where we're going to focus our dollars, somebody's going to have to really explain that to me, because right now it totally does not make sense.
Well, that's a good point, Director Haggerty. And that, as I mentioned before, one of the reasons we're doing the modeling, we want to base more of these decisions on the modeling rather than just the inventory to address that exact concern. Because this just shows emissions, but the modeling would reflect what happens during the day as those emissions move.
Okay, so you're not telling me this is the map you're going to use and how you now deal with grants and TFCA dollars, TFCA dollars and such.
This is not the map we used in the last funding cycle. This is just an example of what we used in the previous MOIR cycle. We will be updating this map. Yes.
With the modeling that you guys talked about?
We will try our best. We can report to a committee. I mean, that's our hope.
Okay.
I'd really like to see this because, Mr. Chair, I need to understand this a little bit more. And again, I understand the 880 corridor issue being parochial to Alameda County right now. What I don't understand is how we're ignoring the I-580 corridor for the reasons I stated.
Well, can you bring that back to the committee and have some information that provide the emission problem in those other corridors? That'd be great. Thank you. Director Ross?
Roughly how much money are we talking for focus grant funding? And could you delineate that? I see about seven red dots. Could you kind of delineate what five or six we're talking about?
Well, again, this is just illustrative, okay? This is the previous map. This isn't the one that we would propose to use this year. But, and that would, I think, would be for the committees and the board's consideration. But certainly there are some areas where there are a lot of red dots, and the cross-hatching will show sort of a concurrence of those sensitive populations and emissions and low income. So, perhaps the eastern part of San Francisco, western Alameda County, western Contra Costa, there are one or two San Jose area, and one or two areas out in central and eastern Contra Costa. Just looking at it kind of jump out at me.
Okay. And how much money are we talking about?
What's the MOIR, MOIR this year?
Well, not MOIR total, but what we're looking at.
The grants for the care.
Henry mentioned, again, this is our initial thinking. We wanted to get your feedback on this. We're thinking that the best approach to deal with the results that are coming out of the CARE program is to target grant dollars down into these impacted communities. And as an initial thinking, we're thinking about like taking 25% and use it for this purpose only. And so I'll look to my grant folks. I want to say the Carl Moyer program runs, it's about anywhere, I think it's actually as high as almost $15 million. This is what we received. So anywhere, we're taking a slice off of that and concentrated in these particular areas as the mitigation strategy. And what you're going to hear more about this through the committee is the staff believes this is an important approach to take rather than a regulatory approach. And meaning like where you would take a red or a green line, if you will, around a particular community and begin to have regulations in a particular area. We think a grant program is actually an important approach that makes more sense, only because the other is fraught with a whole set of issues which we'll lay out for you through the committee, Mr. Chairman.
If we're going to allocate an additional 25% of the MOIR funds to these areas, it seems to me that there should be some sort of matching funds from the local governments or the county governments in association with that, because we also have the need to, and you pointed it out in your presentation, that the local land use authority is the one in which is making these decisions that could potentially create or have conditional uses or things of that nature in those areas that impact that.
So I would like to see us pursue, you know, some matching dollars with those counties so they are acknowledging the fact that they are potentially creating or not really helping decrease some of the emissions that are coming from those areas.
Mr. Chairman, just the push and pull going on here is you have community groups that want to see us incorporate in our permitting restrictions, for example, in a particular community. So we would identify these impacted communities. They would say, no more dry cleaning, no more refineries, something like that. I'll just fill in the blank. But that is wrapped with a whole set of other issues, which we've talked about to the board, who will certainly go into more detail on the committees. We think for 2008, we think it makes sense more to take a slice off of the grant program and really focus it in on these areas. And certainly having it be a cost sharing or a seeking to by the cities and counties to also kick in would make a lot of sense too.
Yeah, that may be difficult to accomplish this year. Get that, Scott?
Exactly. I think what the chair just said is very important. I'm looking at a minimum, and we really haven't even gotten into our budget completely yet. But we're cutting, I'm going to tell you, at least $100 million out of my budget. And your presentation earlier said you're untouched. So, you know, I think we have to be kind of aware of that, and that the overall mission is really, for us, cleaning the air. And if we can't get the support from the cities and the counties in the next couple of years, because I don't think it's just a one-year problem, you know, we may have to go at this alone for a while.
Werner?
Jack, I have a question for you about in these areas that our CARE program shows as high emissions, high population. I mean, do we ever cross the line and go to indoor air and regulate indoor air by saying, hey, you have a commercial development that you're putting into one of these high-risk areas, you've got to have indoor air treatment so that we don't have people sitting for 8 hours, you know, breathing ambient air quality, which is bad here.
I would tell you, Mr. Gardner, that that's actually at the forefront of a lot of discussion going on right now. Henry mentioned some development that went on in Contra Costa County that indeed, that's what they did. They actually got the developer to include some HEPA filters into the actual construction of the building themselves, since they were basically constructed right near the 680 freeway. So it's starting. We think we need to probably ramp that type of discussion up considerably. And I just to respond back in part on the cities and counties, we think that we can only be part of the solution here. I'm just giving you my staff's recommendation that the cities and counties, through their local land use decision making, have to come to the table so they don't make it worse, which is where we come from the staff. Because while we can concentrate grant dollars, we can even talk about regulatory proposals, the cities and counties have got to come to the table to talk about pretty good land use decision making if you're really going to see this picture improve over time.
Thank you. Having the last word, Director
Kishimoto. So you framed it as kind of looking at kind of putting money into you know, grants versus regulation, and you know, we talked earlier about sticks and carrots. But you know, one thing I guess you know, Mayor Bates and I were two people who have